Ending Life Talk Radio. This is a recording of an event organised by Grassroots Oban. It was an online event, happened on the 25th of August 2020, and it features Julian Smith talking about an economy and a clean currency for an independent Scotland. Julian here is giving an introduction to a series of online events which will be organised in the coming months, and those future sessions will cover the topics introduced here in greater detail. Towards the end of the talk, Julian gives information about how to find out more about the future sessions and take part in them. Grassroots Oban and Julian have very kindly given Indie Live Radio permission to broadcast this talk, and we hope also to be able to broadcast the future sessions. We're broadcasting the event as part of our Yes Group Spotlight series, a new venture for Indie Live Radio in which we hope to work with Yes Groups from all over Scotland, giving them the opportunity to extend the audience for various events that they organise and giving us some very good content at the same time. And once again, thank you Grassroots Oban and Julian. We hope you enjoy the talk, and we'll go over now to the recording of the actual event.
Thank you all very much for coming here tonight. We're going to talk about economics and currency. And in particular, we're going to talk about a set of discussion sessions which follow on from this presentation. We can't cover all of economics and currency in one evening. It's a huge subject. And so our aim is to give you a taster to whet your appetites. And then if you are interested, you can sign up for further discussions on various aspects of it, which I'm going to outline tonight. So what this is about, prior to the referendum in 2014, the SNP issued a white paper called Scotland's Future. And it was a lengthy document, a big heavy tome, and it covered a lot of different aspects of what they hoped to achieve if Scotland voted yes. One item in this plan really stood out. It was only 6 years since the financial crisis in 2007-08, and the item that stood out was sharing the pound in a currency union. It was to prove a significant Achilles heel for the independence movement, and we have to make sure that we do not have this Achilles heel the next time round. Not everybody was convinced about the currency question. And about the same time, a book came out written by Andy Anderson and Ronnie Morrison. Andy is with us tonight, and I think Ronnie is also with us tonight, although he's not on video, but I saw his name. So both of them are here, and I'm really happy to welcome them. It was called Moving On, and it attempted to explain why the financial system had failed in 2007-08, and what needed to be done to prevent a repeat. It also discussed the weaknesses of the economic system. And importantly, it recommended a fresh start with an independent Scottish currency issued by an independent Scottish central bank. But it came out too late. It really didn't make an impact at that point. The referendum was lost, and some people felt that the lack of a clear plan on currency and the economic system was a significant factor in that defeat. That many of us will be able to remember Alistair Darling in that television debate, hammering on about what is your plan B. And unfortunately, there wasn't a plan B, because there was no reason for us not to use the pound, but it was forbidden to us, wrongly in fact, by George Osborne. But that was a significant point in the campaign. And more recently, in fact, just 30 days ago, Andrew Neil has tweeted in a bit of a Twitter storm with Andrew Wilson of the Growth Commission. He has tweeted, "By retain sterling, you mean sterlingisation, for an unspecified period during which you will not be able to join the EU, or set your own interest rates, or have an independent monetary policy, or central bank." And that hits the nail on the head, actually. Yeah. He is quite right. We cannot be independent if we don't have our own currency and our own central bank. So this Twitter storm is still ongoing. And there was a reply to him from Richard Murphy of the Tax Research Institute. And that is well worth following if you are into following these arguments. It's been covered very well, actually, by Mike Small in Bella Caledonia just today. So not everybody was convinced by the argument about currency at that point. In fact, as shown in this poll from Ashcroft, the pound was one of the major factors for people who voted no. That line, the pound, 57% felt that the pound was the stumbling block that prevented them from, one of the most important issues that prevented them from voting for independence. So afterwards, I re-established a local Yes group in Dunfermline, and I came upon Moving On at that point. I hadn't seen it before. And another book, this time by Andy Anderson on his own, called Currency in an Independent Scotland. And reading these was a light bulb moment for me. I hadn't really been aware of all the ins and outs of currency and economics prior to that. When I read that Andy had started his working life in Blair Hall, which is very close to us and where we had campaigned a lot, I knew that I had to invite him to come and talk to our group. Now, I'd like to add a few words more about Andy at this point. After Blair Hall, he became a piper in the Cameron Highlanders, then a miner and trade union official in Kent. He was sponsored by the NUM to study at Oxford University, from where he graduated in philosophy, politics and economics. He became a full-time senior trade union official, and he spent most of his career as a full-time negotiator. When he retired, he and his wife Doreen went to live in Skye, where they ran a bed and breakfast. He got involved in the campaign against tolls on the Skye Bridge at that point, and he even got landed in jail. He got himself landed in jail because he refused to pay the tolls. So he's had a colourful life. Now he and Doreen live in Scotcoats, a town made famous or infamous by Billy Connolly back in the Humblebum days. And he's a regular contributor to The National, and you may well have seen letters from him, Andy Anderson, Saltcoats. So I'm delighted to welcome Andy to be here tonight. I'm delighted to see him, and he will be an invaluable source of information for all your questions later. So from there, because, as I said at the beginning, economics and currency cover such a broad sweep, you can't cover them easily in a single meeting. So Andy offers a series of four weekly tutorials to a small group of us who met in a member's house. And he did this twice for us in Dunfermline. That's 8 separate weeks that he came over to Dunfermline and ran these tutorials. Since then, he has delivered them to various Yes groups around the country. He's built up a number of people conversant with his and Ronnie's ideas. And it's become a campaign, the so-called Campaign for a Clean Scottish Currency, CCSC for short. And he's written an updated book with the title A Clean Currency for a Prosperous Scotland, which was what featured on the original email from Ruth when she posted the notice about this evening. Now, a little about me. I've told you a bit about Andy, a little about me, just so you know where I'm coming from. My role has been to convert Andy's materials into a series of 5 presentations, kind of like this one. I'm not an economist. I'm a retired chemistry teacher and chemical engineer. So I come to this with an open mind, an outsider's view of currency and economics. So this presentation, what's it about? Well, I intend to give you just an introduction to tell you what's covered in the discussions, the 4 or 5 discussions that follow, and with Andy's help to answer any questions you may have, and also Ronnie's help if so every so often I'll have a little break and you can ask questions if you have any at this point, and we'll hopefully answer them. Anything about what I've said so far that anybody wants to ask? Okay then. Well, before I start the next bit, just one or two things. I picked up from a book about Walter Badgett, who was a Victorian economist, editor of The Economist, and it is about the difference between scientific theories and economic theories, and quotations go like this. In the physical sciences, progress is cumulative. We stand on the shoulders of giants. But in the economics, which is ostensibly the most rigorous of all the social sciences, progress and error are cyclical. We keep stepping on the same rakes. Anybody that's gardened will know what that means. And that's what we keep coming across when we are dealing with economic theories. Just a wee example from chemistry, because I was a chemistry teacher, the phlogiston theory. How many people have heard of the phlogiston theory? Maybe some of you have. Yeah, I see John put his hand up there. Right. It was a theory that was used to explain burning. Quite a simple thing. When things burn, they are flammable because they contain a substance called phlogiston. When they are burnt, the phlogiston is released into the air, and what's left behind has no phlogiston. It's obvious, isn't it? You burn wood, you end up with ashes which have got hardly any weight. Obviously, the flames come out of the wood. Something is going into the air, smoke and all that. So it's obvious that that's what's happening. It tied in with various concepts of the time, the casting out of devils, bloodletting to let out bad stuff from your body, and burning witches to set free evil spirits. All of these tied in with this idea of burning stuff, burning fuels, and losing phlogiston. It was accepted by everyone around the 17th and 18th centuries, but it was absolute nonsense. All attempts to verify it failed. And in around 1778, Lavoisier produced a new theory, the reaction with oxygen, which is what we accept today as being the explanation of what happens when things burn. It's been accepted as true for the last 240 years, and nobody has managed to disprove it. Now, in some respects, I feel with certain aspects of economic theories, we're at the phlogiston stage. Things like tax and spend, these mantras, tax and spend, that's a phlogiston type of mantra. And the trickle-down economics, that's another one. These are things which cannot be verified and are really just more like religion than anything else. People believe them, but there's no proof that they actually happen. So, first of all, it's perceived as a difficult and complex subject. Economics, really difficult to understand. Many people have said, I don't understand it. I don't know anything about economics. I don't understand it. And the same with currency. People don't understand. I see it regularly in comments and all the blogs. People just do not understand currency or economics. You get it's plainly evident from the questions they ask. The media doesn't help. The media makes them a difficult subject. So you have titles like this one, Partial Differential Equations in Economics and Finance. Partial differential equations. How many people have got enough maths to know what partial differential equations even are? Here's one. Here's an example of a differential equation. I don't know if it's a partial or a differential equation. This is the kind of thing it looks like. It obviously is difficult to understand. It's beyond ordinary mortals. So we need experts to tell us what it's all about. When you see how complicated this is, you wonder, does my opinion matter? Have I got anything to contribute to this? Well, you can make a difference. Of course you can. And what you can do is, at the very least, you vote for people who seem to know about economics and currency. Most politicians give a very good impression of knowing nothing much about these subjects. You can find out more And I'll give you some references that you can go to, even if you don't take part in the discussion sessions after this. You can write to the papers, as Andy does regularly, and Maggie does regularly as well. You can speak to elected members, your local MSP, your local councillors even, and get involved in it and find out more. What about this thing about experts advising government? Do we have experts to advise government? Well, if we do, then how about this question? Can we answer this question? How was it that none of these experts were able to see the crash coming in 2007? And give advice to stop it from happening, because it wasn't inevitable. It was down to actions that were being taken by certain people. It could have been stopped, but it wasn't. Or did they actually see it coming and they turned a blind eye, just hoping it would go away? Well, who knows the answer to these, but they didn't fulfil their role of giving good advice. So to turn to our discussion sessions, we'll cover the foundations of economics and money. I say money rather than currency because it's a word that people understand better than currency, perhaps. And what I'm not going to be talking about is finance. Finance is a different area altogether. It's one we don't need to get involved in. Most people aren't involved in finance. I liken it to the relationship between stock car racing and driving safely on the road. Stock car racing is for a few people to live dangerously. And as long as they don't endanger the rest of us, then we can get on with driving carefully and safely on the road. That's what I think finance is about. All the hedge funding and all that gambling, that is something that we have got no control over and something we don't really want to get involved in. What we have to do is prevent it from harming the rest of our society. In sessions one and two of the discussions, we'll discuss the economic principles as set out by key economists such as Adam Smith, Karl Marx, and John Maynard Keynes. The fact that we're talking about Marx does not mean that we're peddling Marxism, as it's called. We're going to be talking about Marx's economic contribution rather than how it was interpreted. And we'll look and see how these principles could be applied to Scotland's economy. In sessions three and four, we'll look at the part that money plays and the role of the banking system. First of all, Scotland is wealthy. This graphic, infographic from Business for Scotland, highlights just how wealthy Scotland is in terms of the resources that it has compared with its population. We have abundant natural resources. We have a well-educated, inventive people. And therefore, we have to ask the question, why is there poverty, food banks, substance abuse, and so on, blighting our society? In a wealthy country, we shouldn't have this. I just saw today that a young mother was found dead beside her starving baby in Glasgow. I was absolutely horrified by that. In a country as rich as this, that should just not happen. So the answer to that question is, for many years, there's been economic failure of management for the benefit of ordinary people. The economy has been managed for the benefit of a few wealthy people. And so we all need to know something about the steps that we need to take to make things better for everyone. Some of the bad headlines are covered in that second graphic: bankruptcy, job losses and so on, unemployment, insecure employment, inflation, they're all there. None of these things is inevitable. None of these things needs to happen all the time. And so we can influence those that take the decisions. That is our SPs, our MPs, MSPs mostly, and councillors as well. Any questions? Yeah?
John Gosling, it seems to me that one of the important things that an independent Scotland would have to do would be somehow insulate its assets and its businesses against predations from international capitalism.
Right, Andy, have you got a way to defend our enterprises against predation, predatory takeover?
Yes, that was an important question. We can't answer that at this stage in any detail, because the whole nature of the course is to raise the issues that will give an answer to that. It raises the question of the financial system. It raises the question of the value system, the exchange between countries. Very important, and right at the center of it, of the issues that we are looking at. But what we're doing in this exercise is we're looking first of all at the economics. How do you make wealth? What is wealth? How does it work? And then looking at the financial side separately. Then putting them together and showing how the financial system can rob the real wealth away. And that's the sort of thing that you were referring to all the time, you know, right across the world in all systems. Our objective is to create a situation, a completely different financial system, a whole reformed banking system, and an isolated currency, a domestic currency for Scotland. It would only apply to Scotland. We wouldn't be part of an international currency. But these things come later. But you're right, these are the big issues. The way to understand them is brick by brick.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay, that's kind of we will give you the opportunity to raise that kind of question in the discussion sessions and talk about it at length. I see there's another question from Raymond James talking about the list party for list seats, an alliance party for list seats. And he asked, does Andy believe that would open up greater opportunity for currency advice and implementation to take place rather than just one party's viewpoint? In other words, the SNP's viewpoint. My own feeling about that is that I certainly have contacts in the putative alliance party, and I can certainly put our point of view to them. Whether the alliance party will have a full manifesto, including policies on currency, economics, and so on, I don't know at this stage. So the answer to that question is it might, but I don't know. And it's very much wait and see just how the list party, how the alliance party materializes. If it turns out that there are several separate independence parties vying with the Greens for list votes, then I fear that none of them will get anywhere. And so this question would be moot. So we'll just have to wait and see on that point. But I can certainly, through contacts, put our case to people who are thinking of standing as candidates for the list for the alliance. Does that answer your question, I hope? Okay, we'll move on then, I think. Discussion session one starts with economic ideas, dealing with Adam Smith, Karl Marx, John Maynard Keynes. How to make wealth, as Andy mentioned a minute ago, is covered in discussion session one, and that money, or currency, is about how to exchange goods and services. So these are the kind of topics covered in discussion session one. What money is for, and a lot of people think that money is wealth, and in fact they are really not the same thing at all. So money and wealth. Everybody knows what money is, but not everybody is able to distinguish very well between money and wealth. It's confusing because they're both measured in the same units, pounds, dollars, or whatever. And what does it mean if you say that Jim Ratcliffe or Richard Branson are very wealthy people? Does it mean they have lots of the first kind of thing, money, or does it mean they have lots of the other kind of thing, wealth, or whether it's physical things or stocks and shares? Well, actually, it means stocks and shares and other physical things. It doesn't mean necessarily that they have a lot of pound notes stashed away. So money and wealth are not the same thing at all. And when you get the question, where would we get the money for this? Can we afford to pay for this? What we should be saying is, where do we get the wealth from in order to afford to do these things? So money and wealth, we tackle as two sides of the same coin, so to speak. Then we look at the intrinsic value of money. And many people value money highly, but actually money has got no intrinsic value, none at all. And to illustrate this, we would ask the question, if you were stranded like this on a desert island, your boat wrecked, and you were to salvage something from the boat before the tide comes in, what would you salvage? Would you go and look for the box of pound notes or dollar notes? Or would you salvage a bag of tools, a set of carpentry tools, and anything else, raw materials, which might be useful to you? Obviously, you'd select the tools, because money has got no value unless you can use it to exchange for real things, real goods, real services. So bear this in mind all the way through. Money has no intrinsic value. The value of it is in the goods and services that it's equivalent to, the goods and services that it can be exchanged for. So how is wealth created? Now, in Adam Smith's book, The Wealth of Nations, he put forward the idea, and we've paraphrased this because this isn't his actual words. Wealth is created when people use their savings to employ themselves and others, to use their skills, knowledge, and other resources to produce useful goods and deliver useful services. It's the useful goods and useful services that's important. And in order to create these, we use resources, skill, knowledge. So these are the essential ingredients for creating wealth. So Scotland, with abundant natural resources, and I go back to this Business for Scotland graphic, which is out of the Believe in Scotland book, abundant natural resources, educated people, is well placed to create ample wealth. I often say to people when they say, oh, we're too poor at that, I say, well, we only need two things, resources and people. We've got the resources. So are you telling me we don't have the people? Well, we've got 5 million plus people. And are you telling me that they're not good enough? Because if they're not good enough, then the solution is simple. We import experts that we need. We import the people with the knowledge that we need. We hire them in. That happens all the time. So there's no reason on earth why Scotland shouldn't be able to produce its own wealth in plentiful amounts. Any questions at this stage? No? Right, well, let's go back and go on. So we'll start with the economist that I mentioned earlier, Adam Smith, 1723 to 1790. Keep that date in your mind, the mid-1700s, most of the 18th century. He, in his book, Wealth of Nations, came up with the definition that wealth is a combination of resources plus capital plus labour brought together to produce goods and services. He had this concept of the invisible hand of the market. You often hear that term used, the invisible hand of the market, by which he meant that he wasn't talking about a physical marketplace, he was talking about a concept of all transactions, everybody involved in exchange of goods and services, that they, all together, their decisions constituted the market. And the market behaved as though driven by an invisible hand, and that the results, the booms and the busts and everything were the result of the market working, people taking decisions in their own best interests to allocate resources and sell things and buy things and so on. So from Adam Smith, we turn our attention to Karl Marx. Notice the dates are roughly a century later than Adam Smith. He reduced that equation with the three things in it from capital plus labour plus resources just to resources plus labour, because the capital bit of it is really saved up labour. It's savings from work previously done. So he was able to simplify it to these two factors, resources plus labour. He pointed out that the capitalist system has got an inherent instability about it. There's a financial crisis roughly every decade, has been for a long time. And this is because there are various instabilities built into the system. At the moment, the instability is the unsustainable level of national debt. And of course, the virus has just made, has just created an extra crisis on top of the debt crisis. So we're heading for a really serious crisis at the moment. I sometimes think that running an economy is a bit like riding a bike or driving a car, because you're always having to make slight adjustments in order to keep the thing running smoothly and keep it on course. I don't know, you aren't aware of it when you're driving or riding a bike, but you're always making slight adjustments to keep it running smoothly. It may be more like juggling while going a unicycle on a tightrope, because that is infinitely more difficult and needs infinitely more adjustments than the other two. But it's a bit like that. You are always having to make adjustments to the economy in order to keep it from going off the rails. Turning to Keynes, again, another century later, in the 20th century now, or mostly in the 20th century, he was the advisor to the economist advising the Attlee government after World War II. After World War II, Britain was really on its uppers, pretty much bankrupt. The aim was to achieve and maintain full employment. Lots of service people coming back from the war, and it needed to be found employment in order to keep them occupied. The government invested heavily in many different areas, including transport, utilities, the NHS, and so on, a long list. And it put the UK back on the road to recovery from near bankruptcy at that stage. So we'll stop the share there and see if there's any more questions at this stage about Marx or Keynes. Yeah, Andrew?
You've just been using the term bankrupt for the UK economy post-World War II. Does that mean you don't accept the idea that a currency-issuing country can never go broke?
We absolutely accept that idea. The country didn't have any great store of wealth that they could call upon. Yes, I used the word bankrupt in a kind of loose sense there. I accept fully that a country that issues its currency cannot be bankrupt. The currency is backed by the taxpayers, the people of the country, and that countries will not go bankrupt if they have their own currency. Andy, do you want to add anything to that? Because I wasn't around at the end of the Second World War.
The reality is this, that nowadays we understand many people are making it clear, many economists are making it clear, that if you control the fiat currency, you could not become bankrupt because you're creating the currency. And we know that from what's happened recently. However, at the time, at that time, coming from before the war, for many, many years, heavy unemployment was quite normal. It was a normal part of the system. Classical economics, it was part of the system. Indeed, right up to when the war started and during the Phoney War, we still had unemployment at that time. So after the war, in comes the new Labour government and talks about full employment. They're going to have full employment, something that had never happened before. And they actually created full employment. They did it in the way that has just been referred to. They nationalised the Bank of England, and they used they created the money to produce the wealth. Bearing in mind that money has no value, wealth is created by goods and services. They took the valueless money and they turned it into wealth. And that's what happened in the Attlee government. That was the miracle, the Keynesian miracle, which affected things much later. So Keynes is at the centre of that process. Is that clear?
Is that Does that answer your question?
We'll look at this in depth. The whole part of the process is to look at this in depth. But that's basically what happened, that the money system was taken over and the government created full employment. And what happened at the end of a six-year period was that a country which had huge national debt had actually reduced its national debt while spending a great deal of public expenditure and had a whole lot of assets which belonged to the country. So it reduced its debt during the time when it did that.
Can I ask you a quickie?
Yeah.
An economist friend of mine, with whom I've recently frequently crossed swords, says that you'll never get a Scottish currency unless you have access to a bank of last resort. Now, is that a fallacy?
You know what the bank of last resort is? You and I are the last resort. But that's where it is. The Bank of England doesn't have huge stores of wealth that it can pull out. It's the taxpayer who's the last resort. So if Scotland had its own currency, it would have a much smaller country to be dealing with, so it wouldn't need to be bailed out to such a large extent, and it would have to be bailed out by its own people, as indeed with every other country.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah, that's right. It's the taxpayer who's the lender of last resort, or who is the guarantor of the currency.
Something you said, Julian, word debt and the national debt, some people are saying that's the wrong terminology. We should be calling it national savings. And then we would have a completely different mindset about it.
Absolutely. When the government issues bonds, it's premium bonds, that kind of thing. These are ways of for people to save by taking out bonds which are interest attracting and which get repaid. So yes, savings would be a better way of looking at it, the people's savings. It's not always that though, because the financial markets are involved, and that is borrowing money from other people. But as far as national savings bonds, premium bonds, all that is savings, yeah.
Can I just add to that? Yes, I mean, people are talking about the debt in that context, because where you've got a debt, you've got the other side of the balance, you've got somebody who's lent it, so it's a savings. But the reality of the situation is that debt has to be looked at in the context of how the financial system is operating in Britain today and in the world today, because it's building a debt mountain. Now, we're going to have to look at that at some stage, but we'll look at that as we come across. That's part of the process. We'll come to that.
It's a huge area that which merits a full session to itself, I think. So discussion session two goes into more details about the influence of Keynes, particularly in getting the country back on its feet after the war. You remember we had British railways, so we had British road services, we nationalised all kinds of industries and utilities, and the mines were nationalised, and steel was nationalised, and so on. And the Attlee government, as Andy has just said, left with a lower national debt despite having spent enormous amounts of money during that period. A question that people often ask, and that's dealt with in the discussions, is, well, what happened to the Keynesian model and why was it abandoned? Well, that's a big question, and you might want to find time to explore that later. In discussion sessions three and four, we'll be talking about currency, and both of them are covered by a film which was made by Ronnie Morrison about the reasons for the instability of the financial system. I've divided it up into bite-sized sections with issues for discussion before and after each section. And we cover the problems with the present fractional reserve banking system, the advantages of a full reserve banking system, which is what the building societies used to be. And we ask the question, who should control the money supply? the state by its central bank or the banks. And the financial crash of 2007-08 kind of gives the answer to that question, that the banks were not the best custodians of the currency. Then we look at the financial system and why did it fail so spectacularly in 2008? How should it be changed to prevent a future failure and crisis? And maybe we should think about what Mervyn King said about the system at that time. Former governor of the Bank of England likened the bank's creation of money to alchemy. Money alchemy, which just means, going back to chemistry again, alchemy was the fruitless search for a magical ingredient called the Philosopher's Stone, which would allow you to convert lead into gold. Clearly, it was driven by greed, and of course, it doesn't exist. But the creation of money just out of thin air is a kind of equivalent of the old chemist's alchemy, which thoroughly discredited the system. Any comments at this stage? Oh, a fiat currency. Andy mentioned a fiat currency. What would you explain what you mean by that? You want to explain fiat currency briefly, Andy?
Yes, I'll explain that. People are aware of the past where currency was backed up by gold, the gold standard, where the currency, I promised to pay the bearer £1 in gold, you know. That was the original gold standard idea. A fiat currency is a currency that's not backed by any silver, gold, or any precious metals at all. Its only backing is the promise of the government that created it. And most currencies today are of that nature.
And the promise is the promise that the taxpayers make. You are the person that's eventually backing the promise to pay the bearer. And that's one of the reasons why counterfeiters are so reviled, because they're making promises on everybody's behalf that we haven't agreed to. So it's a promise to pay the bearer, which the taxpayer backs in a modern economy.
But a fiat currency is a currency backed by the government. That's all it's backed by. Not gold. Not precious metal, not nothing else.
Okay, let's go on there. Now, that covers all the four discussion sessions. Discussion session 5 is a question and answer session, which brings together all the ideas that are covered in the previous 4 meetings. That's the 2 on economy and the 2 on currency. There's no set content to it. It depends on on where the discussion takes us. And it's always a bit nerve-wracking conducting these, because you don't know what questions are going to come up. But by contributing all our ideas to it, we usually find that we can come to some logical conclusions, meaningful conclusions about any of the questions that people have about it. Now, as a postscript, attitudes have changed since I began this by talking about 2014, because in 2013-14, SNP policy was to use the pound in a currency union. George Osborne ruled that out, although he didn't have any right to do so. Anybody can use the pound. It's not in his power to forbid it. But since then, there's been a big change, and everybody that's discussing currency believes that Scotland should be independent, have its own currency and its own Banca Coolstore na Halapa, its own Scottish Reserve Bank. And so I blotted out George Osborne with examples of designs for notes, which have been a courtesy of Tim Rideout, I think, just suggestions for different banknotes for a Scottish currency. Some resources. Now, In the next 2 or 3 slides, there's quite a lot of information. So the books that I mentioned earlier, Moving On, Clean Currency for a Prosperous Scotland, and Currency, are available from Andy Anderson via Anderson Publications, with Commonweal, they've also produced various books and policy papers, including How to Launch a Scottish Currency and How to Start a New Country. The Commonweal shop is closed at the moment, but it should be opening fairly soon because of the COVID virus, but it should be opening fairly soon. Some online resources. Dr. Tim Rideout has a website called reservebank.scot. On it, there are various videos. There are videos and other information well worth going to look at. George Kevin, you may know about him as well, in The National and in Bella Caledonia. And John S. Warren, I've found, also contributes to Bella Caledonia with very sensible articles about economics. Professor Richard Murphy is very much worth hearing from him. He's in favour of independence. His explanations are really easy to understand, and it's a good way of keeping up with current arguments and current thoughts on currency and economics. And we mentioned Believe in Scotland earlier on, the Business for Scotland website. They've launched a campaign now, and I think their aim is to get independence up to 60% by the end of the year. Some video resources, Modern Monetary Theory. I've got a series of Phantom Power videos on YouTube. This is a much more plausible theory of how money actually works. And there's a short film on YouTube, which was produced by Jim Manclark and members of Yes East Ayrshire. On YouTube, you just search for Clean Scottish Currency and you'll get the video. I think it's well worth looking at. It's a good attempt in ordinary language by ordinary people to explain what the currency question is all about. And I would recommend that film to you. So what happens next? If you want to take part in these discussion sessions, then contact Andy Anderson, whose email address is there, and we can then arrange dates. And these will, in the meantime, be Zoom sessions. In fact, we're finding that Zoom sessions are far easier to manage than face-to-face because we have much less travelling to do.
Now, I had a question put to me before the started by Andrew Fraser. He was asking me about the gap that I had indicated between us getting political independence and bringing in the new currency. And I had talked in terms of 3 years or thereabouts between those two things happening. There's been a lot of talk about that this recently. There's been different voices about how quick you can get the new currency. But he asked me, was that still my view that it would take about 3 years? My response to that is yes, that is my view that it would take that period of time. Because what we are talking about doing is reforming the whole of the banking system, setting up a central bank, setting up all the regulations that would go with it, tying that into the constitution, which is part of our view, and a whole range of things to make sure that when we've got the currency functioning, then in fact it will be safe and secure and operate properly. So we want to get it right rather than quick. And that's why I still take the view that it would take that period of time. However, we don't have a problem about operating in the meantime by using the pound, not sharing in the pound, using the pound for our domestic currency during that period of time.
When I put that question, Andy, I think I didn't quite make it clear what I meant by Independence Day. Right. What I envisage is that, assuming we get a vote on this, that we vote and hopefully vote yes for independence, and then there would be a transitional period, probably of about 2 years, before full independence actually takes place. And my point is that when it takes place, we must have our own currency. Otherwise, there are all sorts of things that we won't be able to do, like setting our interest rates and so on, and we will still effectively be under the control of England. I don't relish that prospect.
Right. Well, that makes the situation a lot clearer, because that gives you a period. I was talking about from the date that you decided and made a political decision, then you've got to implement the institutions. And that's going to take some time. 2 years is a considerable amount of time, and it may be sufficient, may not. Because you have to debate this all the way through. There'll be different views in Scotland, and that's democracy. And we'll have to argue it and process it. However, there's another factor here. I'm talking about in those circumstances, we would use the pound, assuming that the pound is still around. Now, that's a big question. And it's not one that is obvious at this time, because there are real problems in the international exchange situation. And the pound's in a very weak position. It could be quite possible that when we get into next year, and bear in mind, next year we'll be talking about the elections for the Scottish Parliament. It'll be sometime after that, at the very earliest, the later end of the year or the next year, before we get the referendum. So there's a long period between these things happening. Long, not in my lifetime, it's a short period, but in terms of what's happening in international exchanges today, that's a very long period, you know, because there's a lot of pressure going on. Taking place now. So there's no guarantee that the pound or the dollar will survive as an international currency that length of time.
You've been listening to Julian Smith talking about an economy and clean currency for an independent Scotland. The event was organised by Grassroots Oban, and they very kindly agreed to share the content with Indie Live Radio. You can find details of all the resources that Julian mentions towards the end of the talk on our Indie Live Radio blog. That includes how to contact Andy Anderson to find out more about the forthcoming sessions, which are going to go into more detail about the topics which Julian introduced in this talk. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we also hope that you decide to take part in these future sessions. We're broadcasting the event as part of our Yes Group Spotlight series, a new venture for Indie Live Radio in which we hope to work with Yes Groups from all over Scotland, giving them the opportunity to extend the audience for various events that they organise and giving us some very good content at the same time. And once again, thank you Grassroots Oban and Julian.
IndieLive.org.